Okay, sorry about the battery delay. And, well, I'll only kill myself with the cord like I normally do. My name is John Beck, and it is my pleasure to co-direct our daily work, Our Daily Lives. And we have three brown bags coming up in November. So let me just announce those. On November 4th, a couple of wonderful folks from the Ruther Library at Wayne State are coming to talk about The Grapes of Labor and Consumer Wrath, Michigan and the Farm Worker Grape Boycott. Many folks don't understand the history of the fact that Cesar Chavez came in and out of Michigan numerous times during the grape boycott and during the organization of the United Farm Workers, even though they weren't organizing many farm workers here in Michigan. I'll just send those around. And if you'd, they're great on refrigerators if you want to do that. But that's one reason we have a Chavez collection here at Michigan State University in the library. Ann Larrabee will be here the next week, Friday, November 11th, to talk about her work on anarchist bombs, specifically the famous Haymarket Square bombing, and really looking at Haymarket in her talk, revisiting Haymarket, strike, bomb, and trial, since there's a lot of new stuff that's been coming out. And they just found a time capsule at Haymarket Square. And so it's going to be interesting to see what's in that. I have not heard yet. And the last one in November and last one of the semester is Joel Stillerman, who will be here to talk about his work on Chile, specifically looking at metal workers' struggles in Chile, five decades of metal worker struggles. So come hear that on Tuesday, November 15th. Now, there are sign-up sheets. We love it when you sign up, because the fact that that is able for us to demonstrate that people actually came. And so thank you for being here. It's my absolute pleasure to introduce Lou Martin. Lou is with the History Department at Chatham University in Pittsburgh. But Lou feels that he's actually a traitor, having gone over the border from his native West Virginia. And he absolutely adores the state of West Virginia. Did his doctorate in West Virginia on specifically miners in West Virginia. So Lou has been doing a lot of work around the activism around Blair Mountain, which you'll hear about today. He'll give us a little bit of background specifically on the West Virginia mine wars, and then fast forward into today when it's really a war about environmental activism on the one side, heritage tourism on another, against the idea of mountaintop removal, specifically the taking the top right off of Blair Mountain. So Lou is here. He's actually in town for the North American Labor History Conference, which is going on in Detroit. And I think I will turn off the one light so that you can actually see what's on the screen. So today he'll be helping us understand the many battles of Blair Mountain, mine wars, environmental activism, and heritage tourism in southern West Virginia. So help me welcome Lou Martin to Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives.
Thanks. Thank you. And thanks for coming out. This is one of my favorite topics, so it's nice to have an audience to talk about it too. And I also want to thank John for inviting me. I get these emails all the time for the series. It's a wonderful series, and so it's a great honor to be part of it. And so I want to start by talking about the Battle of Blair Mountain of 1921. And then I'll talk about the March on Blair Mountain that I participated in 2011, the 90th anniversary. And then finally, I want to talk about the creation of the West Virginia Mine Wars Museum, which came out of these efforts. So Blair Mountain is a ridgeline, actually, about 20 miles long in southern West Virginia. And in Logan County, which is highlighted there, it's about 50-some miles south of Charleston, and in 1921, 10,000 coal miners took up arms to fight against the coal operators. This was the culmination of two decades of exploitation and oppression in the southern West Virginia coal fields. Miners lived in company towns. I'm sure many of you have heard the stories of the miners, and they were paid not in actual currency, but in scrip. This was a token that was only redeemable at the company store. They faced extremely dangerous conditions underground, and they also lived under the mine guard system. These were armed guards who patrolled these towns, and they would intimidate people, and they would try to prevent the workers from unionizing, in essence. Well, after about a decade and a half of that, they first had a strike in Cabin Creek and Paint Creek near Charleston, the capital of West Virginia, and the United Mine Workers gained a foothold in the state with that strike. Well, over the next 9 years, they continued to try to organize, and one of the problems was that while they could organize in Kanawha County, in the central part of the state, they couldn't get into the southern part of West Virginia. This was just the coal operators so fiercely opposed unionization that this was the stumbling block. And for the United Mine Workers, it was actually pivotal to their existence, because a lot of the northern coal operators were saying, look, if you can't bring Central Appalachia on board and force them to pay the same wages that we're paying, we're not going to honor these next contracts. And this turned out to be a pivotal battle. And so what precipitated this was that after the series of strikes, martial law was declared various points in this period, and the state government was actually assisting with the union busting efforts of the coal operators. And they put union organizers in jail in Mingo County, West Virginia. That's the next one down from Logan County. And so the coal miners were, their stated purpose was to avenge the death of a local sheriff who was killed by the Baldwin-Felts detective agency, these mine guards. And they were going to free their union organizers from jail. They were going to burn down the Logan County Courthouse. There were a lot of other things they talked about doing, but the main thing was to bring the union to southern West Virginia. And so this armed march met resistance at Blair Mountain. They could not get to Mingo County without crossing over this 20-acre or 20-mile long ridge that was Blair Mountain. The sheriff of Logan County was paid, his salary was paid by the Logan County Coal Operators Association, and his whole purpose was to keep the union out. So he mobilized 3,000 to 4,000 so-called Logan defenders to set up defensive positions along the ridge. They had multiple 30 caliber machine guns. They used Thompson machine guns, which had only just been invented. And in fact, a recent article says it was the West Virginia State Police that first used the Thompson machine gun on people. And their goal was to stop the armed march and defeat the miners and possibly kill a lot of them. So the battle lasted for 5 days. But a lot of these coal miners were World War I veterans, so they weren't going to just charge straight up the mountain into the machine guns. They spent most of that 5 days trying to do flanking maneuvers into the various hollers and crevices of the mountain. In the end, we know of 12 people for sure who were killed in this battle, and there's probably at least a dozen more that we don't know about. Because at the end of 5 days, the U.S. Army arrived, and I've got some pictures here. Also, they gathered first at Marmette, and they marched 50 miles south, and at Blair is where they met the forces of Sheriff Don Chafin. And here we see the Logan defenders with one of their 30 caliber machine guns on top of the mountain. Here we see the U.S. Army arriving and forcing the miners to turn over their arms. And so the miners surrendered when the U.S. Army arrived. They said, you can't fight Uncle Sam. Some of them said, now that the U.S. Army is here, maybe the U.S. government will pay attention to what's going on down here in the coal fields. There was an investigation of conditions in the coal fields, but It didn't result in any major changes. There was also a treason trial. 200 of the coal miners were held on trial for trying to overthrow the government of the state of West Virginia. In the end, the only people that did any serious jail time were people who admitted to actually committing murders during this battle. And so there were a handful of people that spent about 10 years in prison after this. But the U.S. Army then was the force that stopped the Battle of Blair Mountain. And the fact that they were now arresting people who had participated led to sort of a cone of silence, if you will. There was a period where miners would not talk about having participated in this for fear of being arrested and put on trial. Furthermore, the coal operators wanted this to be a thing of the past. Let's just not even talk about Blair Mountain anymore. But for a lot of coal miners, this was a burning reminder of what the coal operators would do to prevent unionization. In fact, during the treason trial, they took an unexploded bomb that had been dropped from a plane onto the coal miners. The U.S., what was the U.S. Air Force then, did send the famous Billy Mitchell to Charleston, and he talked about using this as an opportunity to practice bombing on people for the first time. The U.S. Air Force told him, no, don't do that, but Sheriff Don Chafin said, you know what, that's not such a bad idea, and hired private pilots to drop bombs on the miners. Now, this wasn't an effective use of force against them because it was untested, but when they brought the bomb out and they said, this is what we're facing, they tried to drop a bomb on us. That was a dramatic moment in the trial. Most of them were acquitted, and partly because of that. Oops. So when I started to, I grew up in West Virginia, but in the northern part, not in the coal fields. And when I went to college, I learned about the mine wars, but it wasn't until I got an email one day from a friend of mine named Chuck Keeney, and he said, if you want to see Blair Mountain, this may be your last chance because it's slated for destruction by mountaintop removal coal mining. And so this is what Cayford Mountain looks like today after mountaintop removal mining. Chuck sent that email partly because the coal company had made a public road private. And so the state turned over a road that had given people access to the mountain to the coal company. They closed it off to the public, and they were beginning to clear cut the area in preparation for mountaintop removal. Have any of you heard of mountaintop removal before? Okay, so a lot of you know about it well. I just want to show you one thing. When this mining is done, you can actually see these sites from satellite images. When I close in on this, you can begin to see all the pock marks on the surface here. Can folks see those? These are the light spots all through central Appalachia. John, could I have you pick one of those out for me? I do this to show people that I'm not, you know, making this up.
Okay.
So yeah. That one, yes. Okay. The one above it, by the way, you came very close to Cayford Mountain. But this one near Nahoma, West Virginia, when we close in on it, you can see these mine sites have been laid to waste. This is the effect of using high explosives and massive drag lines to carve away as much as 700 feet of elevation. So when we close in on that site near Nahoma, West Virginia, it's interesting that you picked that one, John, because Marsh Fork Elementary School was located here next to a 3 billion gallon coal slurry impoundment. Has anybody ever heard of Marsh Fork Elementary? A couple people have. Yeah, there's even a book of poetry about this elementary school. And a lot of activists have tried to get this coal slurry impoundment shut down. They say that the earthen dam that holds back this toxic mix of water and the chemicals that they use to wash the coal This earthen dam is one of the largest man-made structures east of the Mississippi River to hold back this 3 billion gallon lake of toxic substance they've created. There is an instance of these earthen dams failing in the past, and at Buffalo Creek, West Virginia, it killed 125 people. This school was relocated in 2013 because of the activism around this to raise awareness of this problem. And there's a coal prep plant down here that that creates that toxic slurry. And so this mountaintop removal was the thing that got me interested in going to southern West Virginia to participate in a 50-mile protest march. We decided to recreate that miners' march. Now, these guys were part of a protest in 2009. They got their day in court, and they all wore red bandanas. That was because the coal miners in 1921 that marched on Blair Mountain all wore a red bandana so that they would know that they were on the side of the so-called redneck army, they called themselves. By the way, that term redneck has come to mean usually white, poor, racist, but the March on Blair Mountain included immigrants from Eastern and Southern Europe, as well as African Americans from the South, and as well as the native white miners. And this was at a time when the state of West Virginia was segregated. You had white and black coal miners fighting side by side. But these fellas decided to wear the red bandana because now they were fighting. They saw themselves as claiming some of the heritage of the fighting spirit of the miners, and they wanted to have Blair Mountain remembered as an important site of fighting back against the coal industry. There was also a group of citizens that were trying to get Blair Mountain put on the National Register of Historic Places. In 2009, they succeeded, and Blair Mountain was placed on the register for all of about 6 months until the coal companies got together and challenged the listing based on, they said, there were property owners who were never consulted, and they had a list. Well, it took 6 years, but last year courts finally said that most of the people on that list were actually dead, and these were not legitimate property owners. And so it's being put, well, I'll get to that part. There's a little bit of controversy over whether it's being put back on the National Register or not. But so a lot of people mobilized here to try to get it put on the National Register. So then later in 2011, we had a march. We started at Marmette, and this is what that email that my friend Chuck sent me was about. Marching from Marmette, where the miners originally gathered in 1921, 50 miles south to Blair Mountain over the course of a week. We started with about 250 people at the beginning of the week, and we ended with about 1,000 on the final days. And this march then was recreating that miners' march, but it was also had some goals. By the way, if you look closely, you can see this WVU hat. That's me in this picture. I'm wearing the WVU hat and the orange vest. So the four goals of the march were to save Blair Mountain, first and foremost, to abolish mountaintop removal, to honor labor rights that the miners were fighting for in 1921, and then finally to help bring a sustainable economy to southern West Virginia. So I took these four goals very seriously, and I've tried to carry on with them even 5 years on from the march. And so this march was an important moment for me because I had been opposed to mountaintop removal for 10 years. And yet I had never done anything about it. And when I heard, okay, I'm a labor historian from West Virginia who's opposed to mountaintop removal, and they're gonna destroy Blair Mountain, and they're having a march to save it. Well, I almost felt like this whole march was organized just to get me off my couch and get me down to southern West Virginia to do something. Now I thought, this will be great, you know, we're gonna camp out under the stars, we're gonna talk about West Virginia history. You know, I even edited an article about the counter protests, the tensions, and I was aware that there was this was a very controversial thing in the coal fields. But it's one thing to read an article about it, and it's another thing, of course, to experience it. So when I got to Marmet, they trained us on direct action and de-escalation tactics and what to do if we ran into counter-protests and these sort of things. And they trained us how to sing songs and these sorts of things. I wondered how much of this training we'd actually need, and we needed all of it, it turned out. So the first day we walked 10 miles down to this town of Racine, and we tried to camp that night in a public park. The West Virginia State Police had said that we had permission to, but the Boone County Sheriff, which is where we were located, and the Boone County Commissioner showed up to say that not only was it now illegal to camp there, they had nailed up a sign the previous week, no camping allowed, and then they said, we have made arrangements, we can arrest all 250 of you and hold you in jail overnight. So the organizer said, well, we came to march on Blair Mountain, not to get arrested for sleeping in a local park. So we called all of our supporters, and one carload at a time, they drove us back to Marmet. We got a dozen people to show up in their cars and take three or four people with them. And it took from 10 p.m. until about midnight that night. Then the next day we get up and we learn that all the campsites have canceled on us and returned our money out of fear. So I was saying, gosh, I teach about this stuff. I talk about the power of the coal industry. And, you know, I never expected to experience it quite as personally as I was on this march. So this is some of the images from the march, and one of the concerns I had with these massive coal trucks, over the years they've let them carry more and more weight, and they're up to 100,000 pounds of coal they can carry, and they're paid by the trip. So they get paid more if they can make more trips per day. This has resulted in a tremendous amount of carnage on these tiny two-lane roads, and so here we are marching single file with our signs. We actually got a lot of support from a lot of locals. A lot of these towns are very divided over this issue. Some people depend on it for their livelihood. Some people also see the tree huggers as all outsiders. We had a guy who, one of the common things was for people to yell, "Go home, tree hugger." And so one guy said, "Wait, I'm from Rock Creek." And the guy said, "That's Raleigh County. This is Boone County." Well, that's only 20 miles away. So it didn't really matter where you were from. If you're a tree hugger, you're not from there. So here I am, and this is Chuck Keeney. His great-grandfather, Frank Keeney, had organized the original 1921 March on Blair Mountain. And so that's one of the reasons it was wonderful to have him with us. He teaches at West Virginia Southern Community College. And another friend of mine, John Hennon, a historian who, as a graduate student, taught me West Virginia history for the first time. So this was a great experience for me. As I said, we did run into a lot of resistance, you know, a lot of people who say, you know, go home hippies, you're not from here, get a job. I love coal. Sit in the dark if you don't like coal. Coal feeds my family. A lot of these different kind of slogans that we face. There was a lot of police. The West Virginia State Police brought, it seemed like, half of their troops out to follow the march, videotape us the whole time. But they also, I think, prevented a lot of trouble that could have happened. I don't want to overstate this. You know, I don't think that there would have been massive bloodshed if the state police hadn't been there, but I guarantee there would have been more violence and intimidation if they hadn't been there. So after the march, we decided that the way to continue this work was to have a Blair Mountain Community Center and Museum. And so this was originally opened on Labor Day 2011, about 3 months after the march. But Logan County today is one of the non-union counties. Logan has very few locals of the United Mine Workers left. And by the way, almost none of the strip operations are union, only one of them. And the United Mine Workers actually supported our march on Blair Mountain. But the Friends of Coal is an industry organization. They call it an AstroTurf organization because they pretend to be grassroots, but the reality is they have been created by the industry, and they will mobilize miners to go to DC to try to get environmental regulations watered down, to go to permit hearings to intimidate people who want to speak out about the permit. And the Friends of Coal had a couple of unannounced and uninvited rallies here at the Blair Community Center, to the point where the person who owned the building started to feel uncomfortable. There were other problems. There were internal problems. It's hard to start a museum and community center, and it's hard to, for the people in that group to agree on everything. But the biggest problem was eventually the owner of the building said, you have to leave. And there's very little left in the town of Blair. It's been depopulated over the years, and there are very few other places there that you could have the museum. And so the people that were part of this effort that had sustained this center through a lot of vandalism and intimidation and problems, they were at their wits' end when in 2013 the lease was canceled. So we looked to another town. In 2013, I said, well, let's give it another try in another town. And let's go to the town of Matewan, West Virginia, which is in Mingo County. That's where the marchers wanted to get to in 1921. And because the reason was because of these two lawmen in Matewan had stood up to the Baldwin-Felts agents. In 1920, they had a shootout where Sid Hatfield, the chief of police, and his deputy, Ed Chambers, organized coal miners to essentially, don't tell anybody in Matewan I said this, but to ambush the Baldwin-Felts agents. There's some conflict and controversy over whether it was an ambush or a more honorable gunfight like you'd see in a movie. But they killed seven of the Baldwin-Felts agents, including the brother of the guy who owned the detective agency. And they became heroes because these people who had lived under this mine guard system for two decades, they had wanted to get back at their oppressors, essentially. And so they were the miners' heroes. But then when they were put on trial in a neighboring county, they were killed on the courthouse steps by other Baldwin-Felts agents, and nobody was ever charged for their murder. That was one of the things that sparked the original March on Blair Mountain. But also the town of Matewan in Mingo County has embraced this history. And every year they reenact that shootout now for the last 15 years or so. And so this is a town that's dealing with its mine wars history in what we saw as a more productive way, in a way that we might be able to team up with them and talk about the Battle of Blair Mountain. So we met in 2013 for the first time. And one of the things we did at that first meeting, about eight or nine of us, was to just ask, what are our shared values? People telling their own history and folks from diverse backgrounds working together were two of the biggest values. We were worried that we were going to have all kinds of internal divisions. So we had a community organizer who worked with us to try to make sure that we started off on the right foot. And identifying these shared values was a big part of that. So in 2014, we rented an old storefront. It was a hardware store, the Chambers Hardware Store in 1921. But we decided to team up with the local 1440 of the United Mine Workers, and here were its officers came to our open house. And we put all kinds of papers on the wall that had plans. Here's what we picture happening at this museum. Kenny King, who lives next to Blair Mountain and has been collecting artifacts his whole life, brought some of his artifacts that we plan to display. And so we heard from the community, what do you want this museum to be? Let's try to do this thing over again, but let's try to do it with more people involved. So United Mine Workers Local 1440 was a big part of that, and we put their name at the top of our list. We had a lot of board meetings over the next year and a half where we talked about what we were going to do. I just want to talk a little bit about our original board members to give you an idea of those diverse groups coming together. Wilma's husband was a coal miner, and he's retired now, but he was an underground miner. And Wilma loves this history, loves the red bandana, and she does a wonderful talk about this history and how it brought many different peoples together. Katie Lauer was our community organizer. She at one time worked for Greenpeace. She organized that 2011 march on Blair Mountain, and she has been a vital part of this effort ever since. So she always keeps us on track, makes sure we follow our agenda, and figures out what we're going to do next. You know, get a federal employer ID number. I remember I said, you know, if we can't just rent a space and hang some photographs and tell the story, you know, this should be fairly simple. We're some smart people. We can do this. Well, I had no idea what we were getting into and the amount of work that just putting a museum in a small storefront would take. Kenny from Ethel there with his artifacts was an important part. He's still a mine worker to this day. Greg Galford, who grew up in Boone County, an interior architect, came back to work with us. Hawkeye Dixon, he is the treasurer of Local 1440 in Matewan, and he came out and he's been with us for the last 3 years, helping us get the support of the union and mine workers on our side. Chuck there, again, his great-grandfather organized the original march, and he's a historian. Catherine Moore, a journalist from Southern West Virginia. And me, and then Sean Slifer, who is, he's with an artist collective named Just Seeds, and they have justseeds.org. They do these posters of people's history, and he really designed all of our exhibits and the look of the museum, and it really turned out one. This was a computer mock-up he did, and I was like, man, Sean, if we could do anything like that, that would be incredible. Well, I'm happy to say that it actually turned out to be this nice. This is the storefront we rented in the town of Matewan, owned by the local Rotary Club. And in fact, one of the president of the Rotary Club, his uncle is Don Blankenship, the CEO of Massey Energy. And we wondered, will Don at some point try to kick us out? Don's in a federal prison right now, thankfully. A little bit of justice. So we overhauled the museum starting in the spring of 2015. Sean put some wonderful vinyl things on the window here, including Bill Blizzard, who led that original march on Blair Mountain. This photograph showing black and white coal miners working together. And we created a lot of exhibits about the tent colonies and the Battle of Blair Mountain and the various strikes that were involved. And so this has been a wonderful way. One last thing I want to say about the museum is that we originally thought we'd call it the Blair Mountain or the Battle of Blair Mountain Museum or something with Blair Mountain. We eventually took Blair Mountain out of the name. We said, let's try not to shoot ourselves in the foot from the outset. Let's try to make this a museum that has broader base of support. And we don't have to say, save Blair Mountain. If people come into the museum and they learn about what's happened there, this could be a way to kind of a covert Save Blair Mountain operation, if you will. But it's also history that's important to these people. They are afraid that the next generations will forget what the struggles of the miners were. They're afraid that they won't know what it took to form a union in southern West Virginia. And we actually had the president of the United Mine Workers, Cecil Roberts, and the mayor of Matewan come out to our grand opening. The mayor, by the way, never supported us at all and never even came over to say hi, didn't respond to any of our emails. But once we had 500 people show up at the grand opening, then she thought, this this thing's taken off. I better get over there. And so we're real happy with how this has turned out. And I wish I could say that the environmental movement has just gotten stronger and stronger in West Virginia, but the reality is it's struggling to hang on. But we think that efforts like this might be a way to remind people what the coal industry has done in the state, remind people that place matters, these historic places matter, and that we can all come together and work together. We can preserve some of the identity of this place while still trying to move forward into a different future. We got a ton of media coverage, Upworthy, Mother Jones Magazine, and then Jim Green, a wonderful guy, passed away this past summer. He wrote a book that came out the same year we opened the museum, and then last year, earlier this year, PBS did a documentary as part of its American Experience. Wonderful documentary, I highly recommend it. We're also taking the show on the road, reaching school children. They've all got their red bandanas on and they're all learning about the Battle of Blair Mountain. And this year we started a newsletter, and if anybody wants to receive that newsletter, we have a website that Catherine Moore, our journalist, made. And you can enter your email there, but we also started this journal, In These Hills. We named it after Jim Green's book title, The Devil Is Here in These Hills. And by the way, the devil was greed, according to that quote. And after Jim passed, we decided to dedicate our journal to him. And you can get the journal, that's right. We've run out of copies of the first journal, but if you give us your email, we'll make sure that you get on the mailing list for the second journal. We printed 500 off, and we're doing pretty good for a little building in a little town in part of West Virginia you've never heard of. So thanks for your patience, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Well, why don't you mention that URL since you're being recorded, and that way folks, when they listen to the recording, will know how to get a hold of the website.
Yeah, it's wvminewars.com. And like I said, if you give us your email, we don't send out too many emails. We'll send out one about every 3 months to let you know what's happening at the museum. Okay. And we're going to be doing a membership drive in the next 2 months if you want to become a member for $5 a month.
Okay, so why don't we open it up for questions? I've got questions, but I'm sure other people have questions or comments. So just raise your hands. Question?
Yeah.
I have a pretty naive question, but how can it even be possible that things like this happen in America? I mean, even 1921, they're dropping bombs on our own citizens. And you can look at 2012, of course, not as severe, of course, sorry, 2011, not as severe, but they're shutting down parts so that protesters can't get through. I mean, how does that continue to do this?
Well, now you're going to bring out the radical labor historian in me. And so I would say that the class conflict has been raging in a lot of unseen ways for a long time. And it might just be in intimidation in the workplace in subtle ways. But one of the things that we talked about on the march is that what the people in power, like the coal industry in West Virginia, and I used to say, boy, the coal companies are still powerful in coal country. Then I realized that coal country is all of the United States, because actually they've been manipulating our energy policies for many, many decades now. But as long as things are running just as they should, business as usual, then the power recedes into the background, goes back into their cave. And you have to do something like oppose mountaintop removal in southern West Virginia to see it come out. And I would say that the forms of intimidation and coercion are much more subtle today. And also, they want us to forget this history or to think that it's something from an ancient time and a different place, different people. But I think that as you start to threaten this system that a lot of people are getting rich off of, then you start to see it come out. And so it exists because the CEO of Massey Energy and the new CEO of Alpha Natural Resources and Patriot Coal and all of these companies make a ton of money off of it. The governor, the guy who's leading in the race for governor of West Virginia is a coal operator, Jim Justice. They have taken over the state government and they have run it for over 100 years, I would say. And so that's how it happens. I think there's powerful people who have a lot at stake in these battles. That's my thought.
Well, and just an aside, that the other thing is that the relatively rural nature of extractive industries makes them virtually invisible. I mean, the fact that you can see mountaintop removal from space, you know, maybe tells us something different, maybe a new way of looking at it. But these places are relatively hard to get to, you know, and they just kind of go into obscurity. So here in Michigan, you know, my research, the 1913 Michigan copper strike, you know, 74 people died at a striker's Christmas party, and yet that's one of those great unknown things in kind of the history of the state of Michigan, right? And so there are a lot of places that struggle goes on where nobody knows that they even exist. And I think West Virginia is a perfect example, kind of an extractive colony of the United States, and there were a lot of others as well. Other questions or comments? Back to Anita. Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, I teach the Appalachian Literature course here, and there's a novel by a woman named Denise Giardina called Storm and Heaven that's about it is up sort of around the Battle of the Bear Mountain. It's about the Midwestern Carolinas in 1921. And I always start my course with that, Storm and Heaven. And then I end the course with a novel by Anne Pancake called Strange as This Weather Has Been. It's about what's happening today. If you look at those two books, there's 100 years separating the stories, and the exact same thing is going on. And nobody really has had the power to stop it. So you guys are great. I mean, I think what you're doing, you started small and moving into great ones, was a stroke of genius.
Thanks. Well, and great work, because I think that can always stay. Forest Coalition has come close to killing that permit for good, and that will be only the second permit that I know of. The first one that I know of being killed was back in the 70s in Lincoln County, and now this one looks like it's going to be defeated, so great work on that.
Yeah. You learn about this in our West Virginia history books, and you go to the West Virginia State Museum and you don't see anything about
right.
any of this that happened.
Yeah. Yes, so Chuck Heaney's uncovered some documents from the 1930s where the WPA was writing the history of the state of West Virginia, and the governor, Homer Adams Holt, wrote to have the federal government remove references to Blair Mountain from that history. That was in 1938, and that was the very first, a lot of the textbook stuff was kind of based on that work that they were doing. And then you see very little labor history at all. I have done some work on this, and I saw that in 1954, the state of West Virginia hired a consultant to try to figure out how do we bring in more business. And one of the things that the consultant said directly was, West Virginia has a reputation for violent labor struggles. Do not mention unions, strikes, or anything. That's the way to bring in new business to West Virginia. Furthermore, that Frank Keeney, that guy, he eventually left the United Mine Workers and he started a rival union called the West Virginia Mine Workers Union. And John L. Lewis felt personally betrayed and went after Frank Keeney and his reputation and anything he was involved with. So even the United Mine Workers did not celebrate the Battle of Blair Mountain in any way, or the sacrifice of those miners or memorials or anything, for decades. And so, like, and then the miners themselves have been silent to a large extent. Even when I run into people whose ancestors, they'll tell me a story and I'll say, wow, that's incredible. Can I do an oral history interview with you? No. My parents would not want me to have this recorded. You know, my parents passed away years ago, but I'm gonna keep our family secret. Lastly, I'll mention the CEDAR program, the coal education something. This is, the coal industry has created an educational program where they go into elementary schools throughout southern West Virginia to teach kids about the wonderful properties of coal and everything it does for the state. And so they've really worked hard. Is that what you were wondering?
Well, and just an aside on that, Anita and I have both worked with Mark Nowak, and Mark did a book called Coal Mountain Elementary, and it's a book of poetry and other kinds of text, but basically it mixes up mine disasters in China, mine disasters in the United States, and the actual elementary school curriculum that the coal industry put together. And my favorite part of that is at one point they say to teachers, bring in chocolate chip cookies so the students can break up the cookies and realize how you get coal out of the ground by digging the chocolate chips out of the cookies. But yeah, it's a wonderful book. And Mark has a website called Coal Mountain Elementary that basically looks at a lot of, especially the Chinese mine disasters. Hundreds of Chinese miners die each month in mine disasters in China because of the coal industry there. So, I mean, it's one of those things that's very important to understand how globalized a lot of the carnage, as you put it, on the one side, and frankly, the need to actually support workers. So, other questions that folks have, since we've got time, or comments on the presentation? Questions? Yes, Jim.
Well, two things. First of all, maybe you addressed my first concern in your comment, but I'm just curious about updating the curriculum in West Virginia now at the primary and secondary level. Political. Has that been done so that there's, I don't know what we call it, revisionist history, I guess, at this point? And then secondly, how does this play out? Sort of hesitate to ask this question, but how does this play out in the current political system?
On the question of curriculum, I do not know if the current textbooks mention Blair Mountain. I would love to know that. People I've talked to who went to school 10 years ago or whatever say that it's still not discussed. And so I would say that there's still not a big conversation about labor in any of the West Virginia history classes, or very few of them. But we're trying to team up with schools in the area. We have had And the West Virginia University Labor Education Extension agents did a presentation that, and invited secondary school teachers to it. And we're trying to get more and more school tours of the museum and that sort of thing. So there's an effort underway to revise the curriculum ultimately, but I would say it has not yet happened yet. And as far as today's politics, it's a very interesting time from my point of view, my read on the situation. The state had the Democratic primary went big for Bernie Sanders, but the state is likely to go for Trump in the upcoming election, partly because he's somebody who will at least pretend to try to bring coal jobs back to the state. And Clinton was quoted as saying that she's going to put a lot of coal miners out of work. Of course, the next thing out of her mouth was, and so we need to reinvest in these towns and places that have provided the nation with coal. But of course, that soundbite is all a lot of people heard. I mentioned that Jim Justice is the Democratic candidate for governor, who is a coal operator. The other guy's name is actually Cole, Bill Cole, and he's a Republican and, you know, wants to do away with more environmental regulations. So the coal very much, even in the last days here, is shaping politics in West Virginia. But I would say there's a little bit of a discernible shift in the balance of power where people are, the Beckley Register Herald has been, this is the biggest pro-coal town in the state, and this has been a historically pro-coal newspaper, has now been publishing editorials critical of the coal industry. So there seems to be maybe a change in the wind these days. That's my read.
Thanks for your talk. I don't actually know if you remember, but we met at a Mountain Justice week in, 2 years ago, maybe, in West Virginia. You did a workshop on nonviolence.
Yes, yes. I remember you might have had a lot of coffee that day. You seemed like you were antsy. And yeah, I do remember. Yeah.
But I'm just thinking when you're talking about repression on behalf of the coal industry and the state and how it comes out of its cave at certain points, and thinking about how the coal miners in 1921 and the activists of various stripes today are resisting, but in very different ways. They're not marching with guns to burn down a courthouse or whatever.
Right.
I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit about like the sort of continuum of resistance and how that's changed over time to fit the appropriate situation.
Yeah, even the United Mine Workers turned to nonviolence in a lot of their strikes in the 1980s and 1990s, civil disobedience. And the Pittston strike in southwestern Virginia, they a lot of big civil disobedience actions there. They also did use intimidation and the jack rocks and putting the scabs' names up on plywood by the side of the street and all these things. But now in the fight against mountaintop removal, a lot of initially it was advocacy work and just even trying to counter the narrative of the coal industry is an act of resistance in my mind. But then in 2004, with the formation of Mountain Justice, they were influenced by a lot of the activists from the West Coast who had been part of Earth First out in the Pacific Northwest and came and started to train people in the tactics that they use. And so a lot of this is about holding space, and they use nonviolent tactics like tree sits has been there haven't been a ton of tree sits, but the ones that there have been have shut down mine sites and gotten a lot of attention. And occupying the mine site, chaining the people to equipment, that sort of thing. And so this form of resistance, a lot of people would see it as symbolic, we've shut down the coal company for one day at least. There will be no blasting on this day. No clouds of dust showering the communities on this one day. But other people say these kinds of tactics cost the companies money, and they hope to someday mount enough resistance to cost them enough money to get out of Southern West Virginia or out of the industry. The Kanawha Forest Coalition was really a new phase, because what they focused on in the OVEC as well was really looking at the permit. And what the governor's office said was, this is going to be the best mountaintop removal site ever. We're going to follow every law. We've thought of everything. And within the first 6 days of operation, they had made multiple violations of the law. And so that coalition focused on monitoring the mine site and showing that you have to break the law in order to blow up mountains. And that was eventually how they got a cessation order, and it looks like it's going to be shut down permanently. Does that kind of answer your question?
Let me just, for any of you that don't know what a jackrock is actually a set of nails that you weld together in such a way that it's like a kid's jack, and you sharpen each tong so that when you throw them in the street, it allows you to flatten the tires of coal trucks. So, I mean, just if you were interested what a jackrock is. One quick story, just because... And I would say that the tradition in the Southern Mountains of nonviolence, actually very strong tradition that goes back to a man named Miles Horton at Highlander Folk School and Education Research Center in outside of Knoxville, Tennessee. And one of the best books that has been written actually about kind of the coal economy is really John Gaventa's book on power and powerlessness, you know, in the Southern Mountains. But John Gaventa was interviewing people about coal slurry. And slurry, since it's liquid in nature, often what happens is it flows into streams, which is an environmental disaster on the one side. It also happens to be an environmental violation. So John was with a community group that he was help organizing, and they were with a mine inspector, and they were looking at a slurry going directly into a stream. And the mine inspector looked at the group, looked at John, looked at the stream, looked at the group, looked at John, looked at the stream, and then he showed a map and he said, you know, there's no stream on my map, so there's obviously not a violation. Okay? So I think that this, the kind of history of government collusion, of the use of, frankly, power, not only the state power, but of huge private police forces. This was true across not only West Virginia, but it was true of the coal and iron police across Pennsylvania, true of the use of thugs in the Illinois coal fields, true of Ludlow out in Colorado when Rockefeller ended up with 14 deaths there of women and children. And also truth in many of our extractive communities in the northern Great Lakes as well. So just something to keep in mind as we're looking across that that historical tableau.
Yeah.
Other questions or comments? Over here, Peter.
Overcome that
intimidation. Because one thing about the internet, and it may be that some of these communities are not well plugged in, but at least it's a tool. The other question in the back of my mind was, what's the long-term sort of prognosis on coal resources in West Virginia? I mean, are they going to run out of mountains eventually to knock the top off, or is this going to go on for another 200 years?
Yeah, so there is problem with internet access in a lot of these communities, but even in the Cold River Valley, a guy who's grown up there, Junior Walk, he does have internet access. He's been doing these drone flights over the mine sites and putting that footage up on Facebook. I will mention that there's a fair amount of intimidation that happens in social media as well. You know, even I put up something, and I've got a cousin who's a coal miner, and he laid into me, you know, on Facebook with the all caps post, you know, and I'm not afraid of my cousin, but I know that if I lived in the Coal River Valley and I started putting things up publicly, I would start to worry a little bit about what might happen next. But yeah, I'd say that they are trying to use social media and trying to do it in ways that are going to reach people. A lot of it is preaching to the choir kind of stuff right now. And, you know, all of the tree huggers, you know, we're going to pass this meme around and we're going to give it a million thumbs up and things like that. There's a lot of conversation now. How do we reach across the aisle, so to speak, and try to reach coal miners? To your last question, natural gas has done a lot of the heavy lifting of getting coal mines to shut down. There's been a ton of layoffs. And this is just as sad, too, you know, just to see 1,200 people suddenly laid off. And here, you know, we've been fighting to get this mountaintop removal site shut down. You know, now the people are getting laid off because of the low cost of natural gas and the plummeting price of coal. And it's like, how do we reinvigorate these communities? What do we do for these people? You know, there's not a really sort of a bright future just over the horizon in any case. But I would like it if somehow there was a collective decision made before we destroy the last mountain to say, okay, we're choosing not to do this anymore. I don't know if that's going to happen quite as simply as that, but I do think that things, especially as coal's on its way out, things are starting to shift. It's an interesting time. There are a lot of counties, McDowell County, where Bernie Sanders visited, that county is virtually played out. The coal seams have been mined out. Mingo County is close to being mined out, but there's still enough coal that these companies still care about West Virginia.
Any last question? Well, do remember to sign in if you haven't signed in, because we'd love to be in touch with you. So, and with that, let us give Lou another round of applause.
Thanks.
And see you all on November 4th. And if you're interested in nonviolent struggle, there's nothing better than the United Farm Workers in terms of what was done with the Great Boycott. So come hear about that. Thanks so much.